Oh, thank you very much. It's been a long time waiting for this. Thank you, Vice Chancellor, Sir Michael, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to begin, if I may, by mirroring the protocol of my colleague Judy Seba, who gave her professorial lecture last term, and begin by thanking a number of people so that I don't forget to do this at the end and don't run out of time. First, if I may, I'd like to thank my parents and my wife, all three of whom are here today. And I welcome the chance formally to thank them for their support and love over the years. I was hoping that my children, Meg and Mackenzie, would be here today. However, my daughter Megan, who's 8, informed me that my lectures are just too boring. I did happen to bring my two children to a lecture one day. These inset days at schools are very troublesome. And this is their... These are their lecture notes from the day. My son had not a bad picture of me. My daughter, I'm very pleased to note, if you can see, made some interesting notes about state responsibility at the top of this. So a budding international lawyer, if ever there was one. I'd also like to thank a number of colleagues, particularly Joe Bridgman and Malcolm Ross at the law school, but all my other colleagues at the law school, as well as colleagues at the Sussex Institute, including Fred Gray, who's here also. Moving to a new job can be a very stressful process, as you probably already all know. But I can honestly say that the support and friendship I've received from colleagues, both in law and the Sussex Institute more generally, has been really excellent. Can I also thank very quickly Sue Hepburn and Celia Alexander for helping to organise this event. And thank you all for coming. I really do hope that my daughter's assessment of my lectures isn't true and that there's something here for you to keep you from dropping off to sleep. Two individuals deserve special mention at this time. I've been sucked into international law. It's a subject that I have a passion for. And that really happened. That came from my very first lecture in 1983 that I attended. And we'd barely sat down at the University of Glasgow, great place, when the lecturer began regaling us with all the legalities of the ongoing conflict at the time in the Falkland Islands. And I really was, from that moment, hooked into international law. The lecturer... subsequently became my PhD supervisor, and I've stayed in touch with him and have published a number of books with him since. That individual was Professor John Grant, who's Emeritus Professor of Law at Glasgow and now Professor of Law at Lewis and Clark in Oregon. And I'm delighted he's able to join us today, and thank you, John, for coming. What John and my parents both know, and I'm not sure Kim knows this, but the reason I did a PhD really wasn't about international law. It was really much more about facilitating my budding pop career. Now, this is Big Vern and the Shooters, who you may not have heard of, but they are a very successful band. I'm going to leave that there to see if you can figure out which one of these reprobates is me. I promise I'm up there. And like all good musicians, I will be selling, if I can get it out, I will be selling a copy of my CD, copies of a CD, at the end of the lecture. More seriously, the second individual I would like to thank is Sir Michael Wood. I'm truly honoured that Sir Michael has agreed to give the vote of thanks this evening. I think the VC will introduce him later. Sir Michael has recently left the Foreign Office as legal advisor to the Foreign Office and has been heavily involved in a number of very complex situations recently, not just in relation to terrorism, but also in relation to the legality of the Iraq War. As I said, he left the Foreign Office in February, and he can now be counted as a legal academic, which I'm delighted about. And thank you, Michael, for taking part today and for taking the time and effort. Now, if I may, before moving on to the actual lecture itself, I'd like to talk a little bit about international law at Sussex. Because I didn't just come here blind. I came here because I believed that there was a real strong possibility for developing international law at Sussex. And I quickly discovered that it had already been developed. One of the leading international lawyers of his generation, was a professor of law here, and that was Colonel Gerald Draper. And Colonel Draper was a prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials and subsequently came and taught at the University of Sussex. And his involvement in the post-war development of international humanitarian law is well recognised. And he was instrumental in facilitating the teaching of international law at Sussex. And since his departure, we have continued to involve or teach international law at Sussex. One of our flagships is the LLM in international criminal law, which is the progeny of international humanitarian law, which Draper served so well. And that LLM continues to flourish, and we have a number of alumnus from that program working at the ad hoc tribunals in the Netherlands, in The Hague, and at Arusha, and also at the recently established International Criminal Court. We have a good history of international law at Sussex, undoubtedly. And one of our highlights was a conference in 2003 on the 9/11 events, the events of 9/11. It was led by Professor Harry Rajak and has resulted in a renowned publication which has been co-edited by my colleague Paul Eden. Sussex is now the place, I think, for international law scholarship. We have at least seven individuals on staff at Sussex who are researching questions of international law. And this has led to us developing a new master's program in international law rights and responsibilities. But it's not just lawyers that are studying international law. International affairs and law at Sussex is really a vibrant subject. The spirit of interdisciplinarity at Sussex is one of the things that attracted me here. And we have at Sussex a number of prestigious departments and institutions focusing on international law and international affairs. These include the International Relations Department, the Institute of Development Studies, the Harvard Sussex Research Project on Chemical and Biological Weapons, and the Center for Rights, Justice, Violence and War. Given my interest in interdisciplinary scholarship, the choice of Sussex was obvious. And Sussex was and remains the ideal place, I think, to take up a chair in international law. So moving on to the topic of today's lecture. Those of you who know my previous work, which was alluded to by Alistair, I've focused in on diplomatic and state immunity. And you may wonder, why terrorism? And in fact, the inspiration for this lecture and my current research agenda was work I did under a Leverhulme Fellowship, and I examined questions of the protection of diplomatic personnel. I was confronted in that research by the bombing of the US embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in August 1998. And it struck me that this was only one of a number of terrorist attacks that occurred against diplomatic personnel since at least the 1960s. So my focus came away from immunities of diplomats and how we can protect them from state activity, much more into a sense of how we can protect diplomats who are specifically targeted by terrorists in events such as the 1998 bombings. However, rather than focusing on the sort of low-level focus of diplomatic immunity itself and diplomatic personnel, I wanted in this lecture to develop an argument about international law more generally, to focus on the systemic changes that I believe have occurred in international law since the advent of the new terrorism. And I will talk about new terrorism in a minute. I should say at this point, the result of my research into protection of diplomatic personnel is going to be published in a book. I was hoping it would be published by now. It will be out on the 26th of May, and like all good academics, I'll be taking orders for the book at the end of this lecture. Let me talk a little bit about new terrorism. I was a little bit concerned about this concept, the new terrorism, and what it might put across to people coming to the lecture. I wanted to focus on the international law side of the new terrorism. Although that having been said, my interdisciplinary leanings mean that I'll be talking a little bit about IR and sociological, sorry, international relations and sociological approaches later in the lecture. However, it would be remiss of me to not to comment on what I believe to be the characteristics of the new terrorism. And drawing, you can, don't have to look at the picture anymore. I was the one on the right, by the way. Looking at the characteristics of the new terrorism, I'm drawing on the work of the United States 9/11 Commission, and they identify three factors differentiating the new terrorism from the old. First, the new terrorism envisages apocalyptic or mass casualty events. Secondly, the new terrorism is global in its scope. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, instead of existing as a means to an end, the new terrorism exists as an end in itself. Now, given these key characteristics, I consider that new terrorism did not begin on the 11th of September 2001. The terrible events of that day, in fact, represent only the apex of a problem which began some years earlier, arguably with the bombing of Pan Am 103 over Lockerbie in December 1988, and flowing through to the 1998 bombings of the US embassies. The crucial point for the purpose of this lecture is to see a fundamentally different legal approach between the approach to the new terrorism as compared to the previous approach to the old terrorism. What I intend to do in the remainder of this lecture is to critique the early attempts at dealing with the problem of terrorism by international law. Thereafter, I'm going to look at the changed nature of the responses of international law to the new terrorism. I'm then going to seek to identify one or two conceptual questions arising out of this change in approach. And then finally, I'd like to draw some conclusions about international law and the new terrorism. So dealing first with international law and, if you like, the old terrorism, there's one thing that international law does well, and that's developing rules. There are a multiplicity of rules in international law, and there is a multiplicity of rules dealing with terrorism. I've listed five of the 10 anti-terrorism conventions which were enacted between 1960 and 1990. The other five are on the next slide, but I'll give you a chance to look at those very briefly while I talk. The point about these conventions is that they were effectively a crisis management. They were focused upon ongoing difficulties, ongoing terrorist activities. So we have acts committed on board aircraft, suppression of unlawful seizure of aircraft, very much focusing on the hijacking problem that existed in the 1970s. The convention which I've been most interested in, and indeed one that Michael is very interested in, is the fourth convention listed, which is the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Crimes Against Internationally Protected Persons, including diplomatic agents. This convention looked at the problem of attacks on terrorists that were ongoing. There were a number of kidnappings, which some of you may remember, of diplomats in South America, primarily in the 1960s. This was a reaction to that particular process. The remainder, I'll appear on the next slide, the continued slide, and again, you can have a look at these. What I would suggest is that these 10 sectoral or offence-specific anti-terrorism conventions evolve piecemeal, usually in response to particular terrorist activities. This process, I think, can be referred to as a process of crisis management. Now, let's not dismiss these conventions out of hand, not least because Sir Michael was part of the negotiating on a number of those, so I can't get away with dismissing them out of hand. But it should be noted that these conventions were major achievements. This was a time when international law was much more rules-based. It really wasn't a systematic and as sophisticated and as developed as I'd like to argue it now is. They were major achievements in diplomacy and were innovative in the way they sought to invoke criminal responsibility for alleged offenders. International criminal law is the new subject of international law, but it really, post-Nuremberg, got a boost through these particular conventions. So they were very important. However, international law is dependent upon the acceptance of treaties such as these by states. And not only are they dependent on acceptance, but they require implementation within the domestic sphere. International criminal law was enforced not at the international level, because there were no international courts, but at the domestic level through domestic implementation. The conventions really did not secure enough support. The European states primarily adopted them, but the 1973 Convention on Diplomatic Personnel, there was only one African-Asian state that signed up to that convention in 1973. And I think there are a number of factors which point towards the problem with sectoral conventions. First is the political nature of the offence of terrorism. The idea that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter was very much in vogue in the 60s and 70s. And it caused difficulties for these sectoral conventions. It was a novel system of international criminal law, very different to the Nuremberg process, which had an international tribunal. This was very much focused on domestic prosecutions. But I think ultimately the problem was that these conventions were too singular, too one-dimensional. They were focusing in only on the particular offences which were relevant. Now, I think two particular attacks that may fall within the definition of new terrorism highlight the inadequacies of the singular approach. And these are the bombing of Pan Am 103 over Lockerbie in December 1988 and the near simultaneous attacks on the US embassies, which I've already referred to. John Grant, who I'm delighted is here, it's important that he's here because he's part of my thinking. We've interacted on this in terms of the way that we're looking at the problem of terrorism. What he did in a study about Lockerbie was said, look, there is a new trial process, which was the Scottish court in the Netherlands, but that was not envisaged by the treaty which dealt with hijacking. So although there was a treaty on hijacking, it did not produce any way in which international law could find the individuals responsible. In fact, the only state that had jurisdiction over the, in a legal sense, over the persons accused of the bombing of Pan Am 103 was Libya. And I'll return to that in a second. My own study on protection of diplomats has highlighted the inadequacies of the 1973 convention that I've referred to before in terms of prosecuting the August 1998 attacks. But what I can see and what I'm looking to focus on today is a search for legal responses. And that search for legal responses is apparent in the way that the international states, I was going to say the international community, but we don't talk about the international community. We talk about states reacting to particular problems. And in Lockerbie, this was the creation of the Scottish court in the Netherlands to find an institutional framework outside the domestic, the individual domestic context so that this prosecution could take place in a sort of more international setting. In the East African bombings, the Americans didn't look to the 1973 convention to prosecute those accused of the bombings. They relied on a rather dubious extension of what's known as the protective principle of international law, of jurisdiction, whereby states can prosecute anyone who attacks the vital interests of the state. Now, that's a whole different matter, and it's one that I hope to be writing something on in the future. To some extent, the utilisation of these mechanisms, which didn't previously exist and were really created in an ad hoc way, may be seen as rather opportunistic, perhaps even manipulative. I've already said that the law of the Montreal Convention provided that, that Libya had jurisdiction over the accused in the East African, in the Pan Am 103. Bombing. Similarly, in relation to the East African bombings, jurisdiction really rested with the territorial states of Tanzania and Kenya. And so, you know, in some ways, we can see rather an opportunistic way, led primarily, I have to say, by the United States through its intervention in the Security Council and through its use of this protective principle. But the question remains, if the United States had not sought to prosecute the offenders, if the Scottish court in the Netherlands did not exist, how would international law have dealt with these particular heinous offences? And the answer is that we could have said they were illegal, but done very little. And so what I'm suggesting is that this is evidence of a new approach to a multifaceted response to the new terrorism, a new approach to international law, which is complex, multifaceted, multilayered, and lateral. Let me explain. Rules remain the essential component of international law. The development of primary rules did not end in the early 1990s. But there was a fundamental shift of emphasis, and that was an institutional shift. First, the involvement of the United Nations became very apparent. The United Nations General Assembly adopted the Declaration of Measures to Eliminate International Terrorism in 1994. It followed this up in 1996 with a declaration to supplement the 1994 declaration. And Article 9 of that resolution, or that declaration, created an ad hoc committee. And the purpose of the ad hoc committee was to create new conventions. The point, however, was that there was a move away from sectoral conventions to much more detailed and inclusive conventions. And I'll leave you to read that for a second. Effectively, what this led to, and I will have to move on, I apologise, is a number of new anti-terrorism conventions. The International Convention for the Suppression of Terrorist Bombings in 1997, and two other subsequent conventions. The United Nations has currently is still working on a comprehensive terrorism convention, and there are a number of stumbling blocks, not least the definition of terrorism. But what we're seeing is a move towards more international legal provisions dealing with the problem. So the development, the further development of rules dealing with the problem of terrorism has undoubtedly been substantial. But there needs to be more. The involvement of the United Nations Security Council in dealing with the problem of terrorism has been particularly important. There have been a number of measures that are listed up above. The Security Council developed this policy from merely condemning terrorist acts to declaring them to be threats to international peace and security. And this meant that the opportunity for taking further action against terrorists was particularly available, or was now a new development. In response, direct response to the 9/11 attacks, the Security Council created the Counter-Terrorism Committee, which very much functions as an executive body, looking at what states are doing, whether they've signed up to the relevant conventions, whether they have implemented these conventions within their domestic law. It's taking on a role which, to be fair, the drafters of the UN Charter thought would always exist, or should exist for the Security Council, but which had never previously been utilised. So this is really a look across. It's a look at how international law can deal with these particular problems as they arise. Now, there were numerous subsequent resolutions, some of which I've listed on this following slide, to give you an idea of the type of activity that the Security Council has been involved in. I will come back to the extent to which this perhaps, arguably, has gone too far, but as I said, I'll come back to that. What we can see is a new approach, although one which has always been envisaged but never really taken. So in fact, almost you could say that terrorism, the problem of terrorism, has unlocked the opportunities that exist in the United Nations for developing legal responses. Now, we can look at this in a very positive way. We can say that this is, in legal terms or in terms of legal philosophy, a Hartian moment, a congruence of primary and secondary roles, and I apologise if that doesn't mean anything to you. It even might be the classic Austinian situation where we have finally a sense that international law can be enforced through the punishment of offenders. Perhaps less provocatively, and I'm sure the lawyers amongst us would find it provocative that I'm relying on Austin. Perhaps less provocatively, what I would suggest is that the international community, whether by accident or design, is developing a multifaceted approach to dealing with the problem of terrorism. Anti-terrorism conventions have been supplemented by an increasingly sophisticated role for key institutions, in particular the UN Security Council, and also the development of international criminal law. So the congruence of different responses, multifaceted, multi-layered, looking across the focus of international law. So to that extent, international law might be considered to be coming of age. But there is a downside to this, and that is that the almost blatant illiberalism, which is apparent in some recent developments in international law, and also in domestic law. So the question remains, what limitations does international law place on how we deal with terrorism and terrorist offences? Are there any limitations? Some of the problematic aspects of this response is, as I say, what limits does international law place? We've seen in relation to Iraq that claims of acting against terrorism lead to claims for preemptive self-defense, which leads to use of force against states and against terrorist organizations. That is a difficult question. Other people question the legislating of the Security Council. What right does the Security Council have to legislate on behalf of states or over states? That becomes a problem. Perhaps the thing that we know most about is the ratcheting up of domestic legal responses. Every time there's a terrorist incident, we get new anti-terrorism laws. And states use international law as a justification for that. Aha, you know, all these other states are doing it. It's permitted by international law, so we can therefore take on a more illiberal perspective. And that in itself causes problems, one of which is undoubtedly Guantanamo Bay. My response is based upon a sense of developing a legal argument. I think it's permissible, when we're dealing with something like Guantanamo Bay, to ask, what are the limits of international law? And what are the limits of law in general? We can't shut Guantanamo Bay because there is a power element to this. There's a relationship. There's an IR element to this. Within the context of Guantanamo Bay, what we can do is we can look at the way that legal responses are being put forward. So, for example, there is a legal debate in domestic legal structures about the legality of the Guantanamo Bay detentions. This is occurring in the UK, and it's also occurring in the US. And in time, although not yet, in time, the US Supreme Court and the House of Lords may yet grasp the nettle. But at the international level, international human rights groups such as Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International have condemned and publicised the Guantanamo situation. Detainees, as I've said, have been encouraged to litigate. Many states have asserted the illegality of Guantanamo Bay, and the UN Commission on Human Rights has recently called for its closure. Even Tony Blair has recently argued or stated that he hopes that judicial processes can be put in place by which Guantanamo Bay can close. International law cannot simply, it's not a case of black and white, but what we have is a legal discourse. There's legal argument going on in relation to Guantanamo Bay. It's not simply a question about power. So this, I guess, brings me to a very brief conceptualization. A number of theories have been put forward about this new approach to international law. For example, there is an argument about complexity. And the argument about complexity suggests that there is, it draws on sociological thinking, particularly the work of John Urry, who's a sociologist at the University of Lancaster, who's argued in favour of complexity theory, which is a form of, perhaps best described as a chaos theory for the social sciences. Now, the key site of complexity theory is that unanticipated events lead to unexpected consequences. Applying this to international law, Professor Dominic McGoldrick at the University of Liverpool has suggested that complexity theory may challenge the notion that there is any order, legal or otherwise, in the way that states behave. The subtext of his work is a challenge to international lawyers to effectively think outside the box and to recognise that complexity undermines or requires us to look at a new way of thinking about international law. Now, I agree entirely with both Urry and McGoldrick that the complexity of the modern world is something that we must deal with. But my issue and my concern with this analysis is that complexity in relation to both the social and legal order of things can, instead of giving rise to moves away from law, can in fact give rise to complex legal responses. Why should we look at the complexity of things and say, well, look, this is complex, so we can't actually find any legal solutions? Why can we not think of it in terms of developing the sophistication of international law, developing the complexity of the legal responses to the complex questions? And that's very much why I would reject this idea that complexity somehow undermines the concept of international law. Legal certainty, I would suggest, is a concept which exists at the heart of any legal system, and it's difficult to embrace an analysis such as the complexity theory, which would undermine that essential concept of legal certainty. Now, a recent alternative analysis, which I'll very quickly touch on, is cosmopolitanism. Cosmopolitanism utilises a much more structured approach and in fact is almost the antithesis of complexity. What it argues is that there is a historical structure, there's a historical narrative, and that flows directly in some of this literature from Nuremberg and the Nuremberg trials. And what this literature focuses in on is the involvement of international criminal law in the terrorism question. What they're suggesting is that cosmopolitan law exists alongside international law and domestic law. It's premised in a Kantian perspective on the centrality of international criminal law and the existence of what's referred to as a cosmopolitan social memory. And certainly I have a lot of interest in the way that law exists as a social construct, a point that I'll return to in a second. The difficulty with this cosmopolitan approach is that it relies on institutional structures which are not at the heart of international law. Having built up the international criminal law element, the discourse that we are focusing in on at Sussex, it still remains on the periphery of international law. The ad hoc tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda are exceptional tribunals. They are ad hoc. They were set up for a specific purpose. We have an international criminal court, but that's a new institution based upon state acceptance of limited rules of international criminal law. It doesn't exist as a separate cosmopolitan law. It remains, if you like, a utopian ideal. Now, finally, what I'd like to focus in on and before drawing some conclusions is my own development of a conceptual approach to this new legal response to the problem of terrorism. And that's drawing on IR constructivism. Now, IR constructivism essentially argues that it's a critical branch of international relations theory, but indeed one which lawyers, I think, can grasp and learn a lot from. Constructivists argue that state participation in legal regimes, such as international conventions, can change how states see themselves and what they define as their interests. In other words, there's a mutually constitutive relationship between the agent and the structure. And what I put on the slide is the sort of philosophy that I'm working on at the moment, the conceptualization. I'm seeking to develop a concept of holistic legal constructivism, focusing on both domestic and international measures. I think this highlights the point I was trying to make about the involvement of domestic legal institutions on breaches of international law such as Guantanamo Bay. We can't see international law as existing separate from domestic legal structures in a way which they're capable of interacting and affecting one another. Central to this thesis is the realization that international law is no longer merely a system of rules, but exists rather as a sophisticated, multifaceted, mature and complex legal process sitting alongside domestic law. Now, if I may just draw a couple of conclusions. I've previously had an opportunity to put this put an earlier version of this lecture to the International Law Association, and the conference that I gave it at was entitled "The Tower of Babel: International Law in the 21st Century: Coherent or Compartmentalized." Now, referring to the Tower of Babel theme, the outcome of God's intervention at the Tower of Babel, which was, I think it should be noted, a vengeful intervention, which he undertook to prevent mankind from reaching heaven, was that God mixed up the language of mankind and scattered the people of the world all over the earth. Now, it would be wrong, I think, to regard the destruction of the Twin Towers in New York in the same way. Although carried out in a similarly vengeful manner, the effect was not to destroy the language of international law. Treaties are still negotiated, ratified, and enter into force. Customary international law emerges from state practice and the accompanying opinio iuris. The many rules which regulate, for example, the International Postal Service, international trade, the law of the sea, the internet, these didn't suddenly disappear on 9/11, as some people would suggest. McGoldrick possibly suggests under the complexity theory. We may, I would suggest, yet be a long way from having a truly coherent system of international law. However, and this is my final conclusion, I would suggest that multifaceted approaches to the problem of international terrorism reflect not only the increased complexity of international law, but also its developing maturity and sophistication. Thank you very much.